Okay.
Thank you. Energy scattering, good.
So actually my talk is not that much talk, but more a lecture. And the purpose of my talk is to discuss low energy scattering theory and how it comes to many body physics. What I will try to do is to make a link in between the collisional community and the community of people doing many body physics. But first, I will make a short historical introduction, saying how it comes, where do we start with. And then you know that low energy scattering in three dimensions, and as we all know, at low energies, when the momentum of colliding particles multiply, the characteristic radius of the interaction potential as a function of the distance is much smaller than one. It comes from long time ago. At large distances, the wave function is just sinus kr plus delta, where delta is the phase shift. And as we all know, at low energies, tangent delta is minus ka, where a is the famous scattering length, which everybody plugs into the many-body Hamiltonian for, let's say, interacting bosons and two-component fermions and so on. Yes? So if I look in literature, then the introduction of the scattering length is related to the names of Enrico Fermi and Bertha Pyles. Actually, they were works in 34 and 35, and the famous Bertha Pyles condition was done in 1935. Then there is a question, what is the next term here in momentum? And then we arrive at the notion of the very well-known effective range, where tangent delta is k divided by minus unit divided by a plus k squared multiplied this effective range. The cross section is... Yes, the cross section is sine squared delta divided by k squared, and if k is tending to zero, then delta is minus ka minus 1/2 k cubed a squared rt. This is also very well known, and this is in the textbooks. Yes, then how does it come? First, I would like to say that low energy scattering theory comes from the interest in nuclear physics. There were very many experiments in nuclear physics, in particular for the proton-neutron scattering. And there, it turned out that using this is not sufficient to describe experiments. And therefore, several groups of people came to the conclusion that we have to find the next term. Historically, first, there is the work of Landau and Smorodinsky. Their works range from 44 to 47. There is the work of Julian Schwinger and the work of Hans Bethe. It is quite interesting. I would like to make a historical note here. Hans Bethe, in 1949, has written a beautiful paper on low energy scattering with a very elegant derivation of the effective range and so on. What he then does in the introduction to this paper, he says that Landau and Smorodinsky have surmised the stuff, yes, and they have this, yes, but the real proof, according to Hans Bethe, of the effective range and this type of formulas has been given by Julian Schwinger in 1947, has never been published, and is only contained in his lecture notes at Harvard. What I have done, I have looked in the derivation of Hans Bethe carefully, the derivation of Schwinger, which is quite complicated, but of course correct, and in the derivation of Landau-Smorodinsky. To my taste, I find the derivation of Landau-Smorodinsky perfect. So, I don't know why Hans Bethe puts this emphasis, but it's maybe a matter of culture or whatever, I don't know. Maybe this is due to the fact that Jakob Smorodinsky was my predecessor in the Kurchatov Institute of Atomic Energy, where I was working long time ago. And he's a pupil of Landau. They together have written a book, a beautiful book on nuclear physics and so on. After that, Landau kicked him out of his theoretical laboratory, and Jakob moved to the Kurchatov Institute. Very interesting story. But what I would like to mention here, that the nuclear physics experiments that we are talking about now were done at energies of 10 or 20 mega electron volt, which for us doing ultra cold atom physics is a huge energy. So how comes that this is like that? Because the characteristic momentum of particles is larger than 10 to 12 inverse centimeters. The reason is that the characteristic radius of nuclear forces is very small. It ranges, it usually is several Fermi. One Fermi is 10 to the minus 13 centimeter. It ranges from 10 to minus 13 to 10 to minus 14. And then I get this condition, K, momentum, multiply the effective radius of the potential much smaller than one. Yes? So therefore, the ultra-cold physics first comes from nuclear physics studies at energies of tens of mega electron volts. Very interesting remark. And but all these formulas we are now actively using in the physics of ultra-cold atoms in the scattering theory in three dimensions. Yes? But they come from nuclear physics at tens of mega electron volt energies. Then what I had done, I had a look about the two-dimensional low energy scattering. If you open textbooks, and according to my taste, I usually open Landau Lifshitz, yes, and one can open many other books, then what you find is that the low energy solution, the same condition, KR effective much smaller than one, says that the tangent delta, the phase shift delta is coming from the asymptotic form of the wave function of colliding particles. It's unity divided by the logarithm. Very well known result. And the short range physics, or the characteristic length of the potential, is sitting here under logarithm. And here I put question marks. I did not find in literature the next terms, although for short range, the very short range potentials, they are very easy to obtain. Moreover, I failed in finding who was the first to write down this formula. You know, very many people were writing down this formula, yes, not even referring to each other, and then you find textbooks. And this is because during many tens of years, let's say several tens of years, this formula exists, yes, it was more or less academic problem. There was no concrete system where it can be applied in a pure way. Moreover, what I have seen, I think it was a couple of years ago, that one of the members of the cold atom community has written a theoretical paper, very serious, and it has been published in Physical Review, where he has derived this formula. Yes? Yes, I will not say the name, but it's interesting that, okay, but it's correct. Yes, it is correct. So what I will do now, I will discuss the dipole-dipole scattering in two dimensions and how it comes to many-body physics. So imagine that the translational motion of the dipoles is two-dimensional and they're all perpendicular to the plane of their translational motion, like that. Then at large distances, the interaction potential is dipole moment in the square divided by r cube. And then, in order to reduce all formulas, I introduce the characteristic dipole-dipole distance, which is the mass multiplied dipole moment in the square, divided by, excuse me, which is h bar squared. I can always put h bar equal to 1. This is a characteristic range of the potential. A distance is much larger than this r star. The motion of particles is free, and the distance is of the order of this r star. It is influenced by the interaction. And then the ultra-cold limit, or the S-wave scattering limit, if you wish, is determined by the condition k r star much smaller than 1. Then, what usually people do, they write down the wave function as an incident wave, plane wave, plus scattered wave exponent, IKR, with the scattering amplitude. In the S wave, the scattering amplitude, just a simple integral from the Bessel function, J0, interaction potential, the true wave function. And then, knowing that the asymptotic shape is like that with the phase shift delta, you obtain a relation between the scattering amplitude and tangent delta. It's like that. The scattering amplitude, as we all understand, is complex. So if KR star is much smaller than 1, and we are away from resonances, then this phase shift delta is much smaller than 1. This logarithm is big, yes? So, what I will do now, I will make a small trick. I will say that it is more convenient to normalize the wave function in such a way that at large distances it behaves this way. J0 minus tangent delta N0, where this is the Bessel function, this is the Neumann function. Then this function and this function are related to each other through a very small relation. The new one and the old one, it's unity minus I tangent delta. Then, if I substitute here the new wave function, yes, this psi, I obtain a new amplitude f, which is real, and the true scattering amplitude and the new one are also related to each other through this relation, unity minus I tangent delta. Why am I doing this? For two reasons. First of all, it's more convenient to deal with this amplitude or with the phase shift because they are real. Second, it will turn out that this is this guy who is entering many-body physics. I will show in a later stage how it comes. Now, let me do the following. Let me do something which is boring, yes? Why it is boring, I will tell you in a minute. You know, people in Laboratoire Physique Théorique et Modèle Statistique, where I'm a member, are asking me, are you doing collisional physics? I say, no, I'm doing scattering theory. The difference is very small. But for theoreticians who do field theory, it's important. Yes? Here, yes.
You mean they don't like collisional physics there?
Well, they say collisional physics, spectroscopy, it's chemistry or chemistry-related things. You should do exactly solvable models, field theory, bosonization, diagrammatic approaches. This is what I'm also doing. I don't care. Yes. So then let me continue here. So my interaction potential is d squared divided by r cubed dipole at large distances. And let me assume that at short distances, we can do something with this potential. Apply resonance, disturb this potential, it's something else, yes? Then, how do I do theory here? For simplicity, I divide the region of distances into two parts. Region 1, where r is smaller than this r0, and region 2, where r is larger than r0. And R0 is taken such that it's much smaller than unity divided by K. K is the relative momentum, the Broglie wavelength, and much larger than R star. So, therefore, at distances larger than R0, the motion is free. And in principle here, next to R0, I can throw in the Schrödinger equation both interaction potential and kinetic energy. But I still keep on this side the interaction, and on this side, I keep the kinetic energy. Yes. This is absolutely not a problem. So then, what I do, in this inner region, region 1, I write down the zero energy solution of the Schrödinger equation. Here, I would like to make a historical remark, that if I close this term, put zero energy, then there is analytical solution of the Schrödinger equation for the relative motion of particles for any power law potential. It's in the textbooks. Once I include this, then the number of potentials for which the analytical solution in terms of special function exists is very small. It exists for the Coulomb interaction, for unity divided by R squared interaction, and Vanier has written a remarkable paper in 1952 where he has obtained the exact solution at finite k for unity divided by R4 potentials. It's a absolutely beautiful paper where the wave functions are expressed in terms of Koch-Mathieu functions and so on. People who really like mathematical physics usually refer to this paper. Although, when you pick up the solution of Vanier and wish to do something with this Koch-Mathieu function, you can do very little.
Yes? Once you nest many special functions together, I don't see how it's really a useful exact solution. So if you have, 13 different special functions from all over Brumitz and Stegen,
no, there are only two different functions.
A numerical, representation can be better. So.
Lincoln. Let me comment on on your remark later. You know, if there is an analytical solution, a theorist should present an analytical solution. Yes? If the analytical solution does not exist, then you do numerics.
You can comment on the fact that the potential is never an inverse power anyway, so...
Sure. I should comment on Bogao's, one of our six analytic solutions, too, which has which Bogao did a few years ago.
Who?
Bogao. Uh-huh. You might not know Bo. I'll have to tell you about it. He's got analytic solutions for the Van der Waals potential.
For finite,
energy, yes.
Okay, this I'm surprised with, but maybe.
Well, that is a 3D, right?
It's not 3D. It's 3D, not 2D. Okay.
Yeah.
It's 3D.
Because the Vanier solution.
You're talking specifically of 2D here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The Vanier solution, by the way, exists in both 3D and 2D. Okay. Yes?
Just the condition that you made that this Earth star very small compared to RZO and compared to 1 OK. It means that basically RZO is at infinity. That means that there is no interaction because it is much larger than the effective range of the.
No, the interaction is still there, and you will see what this
small.
Is.
I mean,
No. First of all, it is much smaller than the de Broglie wavelength. Yes? And this is very important. I will explain you.
So if you have K S star, which is smaller than much smaller than 1.
Yes. And K R zero is also much smaller than 1.
But even more smaller, right?
But you know, Olivier, your remark means that you have never looked in volume number 3 Landau Lifshitz. What they say.
So we'll discuss after.
Yes. Yes. You know, the thing is the following, that. There is the so-called anomalous scattering. You know, people are used to think that the scattering comes from short distances where the distance between particles is of the order of the characteristic range of interaction. Yes. However, for power law potentials which do not decay very rapidly, there is the so-called anomalous scattering, which comes from distances of unity divided by k, de Broglie wavelength. Look here. Imagine, please, that you have unity divided by R cubed in 2D, yes? Or unity divided by R4 in 3D, it doesn't matter. Then you write down the, let's say Born, yes? Then you write here J0 squared KR 2 pi R dr, yes? And then, you know, you single out short-range physics by putting here minus 1, and then you multiply by k here, by k here, and here k cubed, and you will see that there is a contribution of the order of k, and it comes from distances of the order of the de Broglie wavelength. This is the so-called anomalous scattering. It's very important in 3D for unity divided by R4 potentials, in 2D for unity divided by R cubed and R4. So, if the power law potential does not decay very rapidly, then these type of distances are very important. If it were Van der Waals potential in 2D, no question, I do the problem very differently. So now what I will do, in region 1, I will take the zero energy solution. I was not able to find an analytical solution for finite k for n divided by R cubed and 2D. If there is a great guy who can do that, that's fine. Then, and I add the kinetic energy as perturbation. In region 2, I consider free particle motion because R0 is much larger than R star, and add the potential U over R as perturbation in first and second order. Yes? This is because of the anomalous scattering. Then, what I do, I match the logarithmic derivatives of the wave function at this point, R0. Yes? And then I should find the result. Yes? Now I would like to make a remark here that when I deal with region 1, what this is? This is zero energy solution. This is the contribution, the perturbative contribution of the kinetic energy. The zero energy solution is expressed in terms of decaying and growing Bessel functions, K0 and A0. And there is a coefficient A, which depends from what is happening here at short range physics, yes? And then, if, for example, my dipoles, the dipole-dipole interaction is like this at any distance r, then this A is zero, yes? And if it's something else, there is a coefficient. Then in region 2, it's just psi 0, the amplitude of wave function is just free motion wave function, yes? And this delta 0 is easily obtained by matching this guy with this guy. And then there are perturbative contributions, first order contribution, where g is the Green function, and second order contribution. You easily see from here that this contribution will mostly give terms proportional to k, and this contribution will mostly give terms proportional to k squared. So the contribution to the phase from here I call tangent delta 1, from here tangent delta 2. Yes, and then there is the final expression, yes? Then I calculate all this. You know, if there are people who are interested in how I do calculations, you are welcome to approach me, and I show you these calculations, which I have done myself, yes, without PhD students and so on, yes? You know, when I was a kid, kid means I was an undergraduate student or a PhD student, I was more or less taking from 20 to 50 integrals per day. I am still doing this from 10 to 20, 30, slightly less than, you know. For someone who is over 60, it's a very nice exercise, yes? And then, you know, but as usual in two dimensions, this bloody logarithm comes into play. This is my final expression for the phase shift. This is my main term, pi over 2 divided by q, where q is the logarithm. It's the same as it is here, yes? Plus k term, which is anomalous scattering, first order, plus k squared term, which is like this. So it's k squared logarithm. And then this guy is the contribution of short-range physics, which also contains these logarithms, so it may partially cancel this. And this q, which is in here, it's logarithm kr star, and there is a numerical coefficient, which contains short-range physics. It's here. It's here in Q and here. If the dipole-dipole interaction of this form is at any distance, then this coefficient A here is equal to zero, yes? Then everything is nicely calculated. It's more or less the same formula, yes? And then I see that the K squared term, this term, corresponds to attraction, yes? Now, let me do something. Let me try to show you how comes. Let me do something at short distances, perturb this potential, introduce a resonance. Just as an exercise, I took this potential, unit divided by r cubed, then potential. And this distance r1 and u0, I select such that it's slightly below 1.086. Then, in this potential, the bound state does not exist, but is just about to appear. People who know very well the scattering theory can immediately comment, saying that we all know that in the two-dimensional case, there is always a bound state. But it only exists when the potential is like that, yes? For example, if I take a potential like that with a hard core, the bound state may exist or may not exist. It's the same here. For this potential, there is at least exponentially bound state with an exponentially small binding. Yes. Then, what I do all these calculations and so on, and I obtain the scattering amplitude. This is my first term, which is right here. Yes. Then I already write the amplitude. This is the k term, which corresponds to attraction. And this is k squared term, which here corresponds to repulsion. Depends where I put this r1. For example, if I put r1 equal to r star, the coefficient alpha here, 3.3. If I wish to get alpha larger, I put r1 larger. If I wish to have it smaller, it will be somewhere here. Then, let me see. You know, you may ask me, why are you doing that? Is it an interesting academic exercise which you should report to students? Or there is something behind? And the reason that I'm giving this talk says that there is actually something behind. Why? Of course, I agree with Jeremy and I agree with Paul that what I do, I plug in the two interaction potential, and this amplitude I calculate numerically as a function of k. I have absolutely no objection against that. Moreover, I very much support this approach, and you will see in a minute why. Look here. I obtain this. My analytical representation simply allows to understand things. Now, what I will do, I consider identical bosons. I write down the Hamiltonian kinetic energy term plus the interaction term, where the coupling constant is in principle momentum dependent. And then I just reduce it to the Bogoliubov form and diagonalize the Hamiltonian. Everybody knows how to do that. Let me now do something wrong. Yes? Something wrong means that what I should do in principle, I should turn to the vertex functions, draw diagrams, and then write down an equation for the vertex function through the off-shell scattering amplitude and so on, and then proceed for this Bose-Einstein condition. This is called the Beliaev theory. But if I do this, let me tell you that I have done this exercise, yes? Long time ago, Spartak Beliaev was one of my teachers when I was a kid. Well, not kid, but young son. Yes. In fact, it's more or less correct to replace this J over K by this amplitude F, as it turns out. Then the excitation spectrum is like this, square root of free particle energy multiplied 2NG over K free particle energy. The difference from the very well-known Bogoliubov spectrum, which we draw for, let's say, contact repulsive interaction, is that J here is this guy, F. It depends on K. There is a term which is attractive, minus K, and there is a term which is repulsive. Yes? And this term is positive but small. So first, because this term is positive but small, for very small K, I get sound-like behavior. Then the guy reaches maximum. Yes? Then because of this term, it goes down. And then because of the kinetic energy here and the k-squared term here, it goes up. What you see is that if I do something with the interaction potential at short distances, I may get a Rotem maxon structure in the excitation spectrum. And the position of the Rotem when it is very close to zero is more or less twice the inverse Hilling length, more or less, not exactly. Then, what we expect is that...
So, Jorge, I mean, in terms of this Xi star, that Hilling length is what?
Hilling length is...
I mean, if it goes forward, it's...
Hilling length is H bar divided by square root of N and G. Yes, it's Hilling length for a condensate. It's Hilling length for a condensate, where for G, you have to substitute this guy, the first term. It is much larger than our star, yes?
But where did you do any mean field theory? Just in getting your Bogoliubov spectrum, you're assuming that you bounce off a mean field theory, and that's what gives you the Hilling length as an important scale?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is. And then what I am assuming is that the Hilling length is much larger than our star, yes? And that's what it is. You can easily check that. So this is just mean field. There is nothing sophisticated.
The reason...
2D. You know, of course, what everybody can say, that Jora in 2D at a finite temperature, there is no true condensate and so on. But let me now just put these comments aside. Let me say temperature is zero. Then in 2D there is a true condensate. Yes, I'm not going now to discuss phase fluctuations and so on. Yes, that's what it is. So, all conditions of the mean field regime are satisfied. The thing is that here, if the Rotem touches zero, then you expect two things. Either the appearance of a new state, which we call supersolid state, it's the condensate wave function will be, let's say, uniform background plus a lattice structure on top of it, or you expect a collapse. It is very important that this idea was picked up by some people, yes, and they, I think they even published a paper or put it on the web, The thing is that what you should always do in order to check whether your superfluid is good in the mean field regime, you should calculate the compressibility. Yes. What I did not tell people is that in most cases, when the Roton touches zero and you calculate the super solid state, the compressibility is negative. The negative compressibility means that there is a collapse, and I think that people who were exercising with me in the past, in particular Guido and Luis, where is Luis? They were obtaining this collapse as well as Paolo Pedri. You have to very carefully select the conditions in order to get a stable super solid state in this case. Yes? There is, of course, the question whether something interesting exists in the system when the Roton minimum is still above zero. There is something, and but this probably requires extra considerations. Now, what I would like to say is that if there are questions related to that, I will answer them. If not, I'll... Yes.
Yes, just one question, Jura. And you have dipolar bosons here.
Yes.
If you had non-dipolar bosons, just point contact bosons, how does this Roton spectrum change?
The thing is that here, this guy, the Roton, appears due to this money state term in the amplitude. So, if I just use this approach and replace dipoles by something else, unit divided by R4 or unit divided by R6, nothing like that exists. Yes, this type of physics, minus K term at least, is absent. In principle, what people have done, and this is already in literature, Nikolai Prokofiev has written a very nice overview article on super solids. What they say is that if I think it's both 3D and 2D. You take a potential which is flat at short distances, and then it decays in some way. Then you may get a super solid state. But this is not related to what I am saying, because now so many people have written so many papers on super solid states that writing one more paper, even taking into account that I was at the core of these studies a long time ago, is not useful. One should invent something else. And that's what I have done. Yes, but let me talk about that next time. But you are right that in some cases, what people say, and they have checked it in the mean field and by doing Monte Carlo, that if you take this type of potential, which is flat and then decays, you may get a super solid state. And the reason is very, very interesting. That what we usually think is that in order to get attraction or BCS superfluid pairing, you need an attractive potential. Yes, this is correct. But what happens is that if you have a repulsive potential like that, which goes like that, then the Fourier transform can become negative. Yes? And then this type of things, negative for certain momenta. This type of, let's say, findings, they rely on that.
You were standing in front when you changed how you were drawing the potential. What makes the Fourier transform? Can you say that about the Fourier transform being negative again?
Yes.
I just couldn't see what you were...
Yes, if you put it like that...
Just stand to one side when you do it.
Oh, excuse me.
That's okay.
The fact that you truncate.
Yeah.
And this is known. I think it was written in the paper by this guy, Thomas Paul, they were having this type of potential.
Yeah, we had it. So this is the kind of, this is the super solid force.
Yes. So, but this is very well known. Moreover, people say that for this type of potentials with a certain decay, it's even Gross who first mentioned that there is this negative Fourier transform and so on.
So don't you just need more than one? So is it enough to have more than one power law? Does it actually have to truncate like that? Can it still tail away?
Yes, it can.
Yes.
Just a minute. This is not me who was doing that. It can decay as a certain power law. Not any power law, but it can decay like that.
Yeah. you basically need a couple of scales in the problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
Something
sort of
like that.
Software potential with a tail will do that.
Yes, okay. Something like that, and people have done that by doing both Monte Carlo and.
And the problem of the subway dimension is faster than 1 meter squared.
Something like that. Something like that. Now, are there more questions? Yes, Paul.
Yeah, there's a question about the when the rotund minimum comes in, because you can have dipoles and turn up the dipole strength. So if the dipole strength was zero, you say it would not exist.
Uh-huh.
You turn the dipole up. Does the dipole length then have to get larger than the harmonic confinement length and any other length scale in the problem?
No.
Or what's the condition of the dipole length to get the minimum?
Ah, the thing is, by saying dipole length, you mean this R star, which is mv squared, and so on.
Yes, this one, yeah.
You know, it should be such that this term is sufficiently important, but on the other hand, it should not be very large. It should be smaller than the Hilling length. Otherwise, my approach doesn't work, and the spectrum doesn't.
Well, I don't see the confinement length there. Where would the confinement length come in?
Ah.
Because you've got it 2D, or is this strict 2D?
Strict 2D.
You're not doing quasi 2D.
Just
I see. Okay.
Yes. I am doing strict 2D, but if you wish to have, let's say, quasi 2D, yes, then my R star, what I am doing, is certainly valid when R star is larger than the confinement.
Right, okay. That's what I thought.
Strictly, yes. If you and then this confinement length, it comes into this short range constant A. Yes? It comes here. Yes. If R star is of the order of the confinement length, then there are some kind of tricks that you can do. But strictly speaking, in order to shorten the discussion, for the quasi 2D, R star is larger than the confinement length. Yes? Strictly speaking. There are many other things that one can do here. I simply do not focus on that. Yes? Now,
yes. What about these confinement-induced resonances that you will have in the system?
Sorry?
Confinement-induced resonances that you will have due to this exploring of the third dimension.
Confinement-induced resonance.
Because Olshani in 1D, then you can have it also in 2D. Similar.
You know, when you are talking about 2D, you are right about 1D. But when talking about 2D, you should say Alla Petrov Schlappen.
Alla Petrov Schlappen.
Yes. This would be correct, politically correct, you know. I would say that all this Olshani in 1D and us in 2D, these confinement-induced resonances have been obtained for short-range interacting potentials, not for dipole-dipole. For dipole-dipole, they exist, but the problem, to my knowledge, has not been solved. Yes.
Because in principle, all your scattering theory is just assuming that you are in a single chunk.
Yes, exactly.
I think Maxime said something in Medan on this, and he sent me a reference. I'll dig it out, but...
Yes, but you know, if you look in all this, with true dipole-dipole scattering, and you include dipoles, the problem of confinement-induced resonances is still open.
We published a numerical calculation on the resonances as confinement changes, but it's all totally numerical.
Ah, okay. Then I'm really sorry, Paul. If you have done that, you have done
that.
Okay. Yes.
There's nothing analytic about it.
Because in one dimension, we studied this problem of positionally induced resonances, right?
Yes. You know.
But in 1D, what you have is basically that with the double interaction, you can shift the
position of the resonance. Yes. Maybe you give me a little bit of 5 minutes to say something which can be more important. Because.
You have 15 minutes, right? So take your time.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. So, for this purpose, what I have to do, would you allow me to erase the super solid stuff, or I better erase something here? What should I erase? Tell me.
Did anybody grab pictures of this?
I got a picture of everything he's got up there. Except the latest edition.
So we'll get that up on the
okay.
Yeah, don't erase anything you
want. Okay, then I just erase this.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Then let me say something else. And this something else can be important. Let me now assume that instead of bosons, I have two-component fermions. Yes, and then I do the same as here. This alpha I can put, I can make not very large, of order one or smaller by putting R1 here. Yes, I can make this Q extremely large. Yes, therefore this term dominates. Yes, and you get attraction. The amplitude is attractive. You get superfluid pairing, which I will do in the BCS approach. Yes, in the BCS approach, what you do, you write the BCS Hamiltonian, yes, which is sum over alpha. Alpha is the spin index, d2r integral, yes, psi dagger alpha, yes, minus h squared divided by, I think, 2m, yes, nabla squared psi alpha, yes, I don't write daggers here. I think here I should put minus mu. Yes, plus the interaction, one half here. What remains out of the interaction here is the order parameter, yes, which is delta star r prime, yes, multiplied psi up over r psi down over r prime, yes, plus Hermitian conjugate. Yes. Then, where this delta is defined as the interaction potential in the coordinate space multiply the average value of psi down over r prime, psi up over r. Yes, that's what you do. Very, very general thing. Then, this is a bilinear Hamiltonian. I'm just following very old works, which are now in old textbooks. You diagonalize this Hamiltonian by a canonical transformation, and then what you do, you get the spectrum, which has a gap, yes? Epsilon over K. Here is K Fermi, the Fermi momentum. Yes, it has a gap. Yes, and then how to find this? This spectrum can be written like that: epsilon k is square root of E k minus E Fermi. The chemical potential is almost Fermi energy. Yes, in the weakly interacting region, and this is the Fourier transform of this order part. Now, what I will do, I will say that the equation for the order parameter, maybe I erase this, yes? Paul made photographs of all this, so in case I miss something, he can do the investigation, yes? And then, you know, the equation for the order parameter is called the gap equation, yes? People from many body physics, please excuse me very much, because you all know what is here, yes, but it's minus d2q, yes, divided by 2 pi, in my case in the square, because I'm in 2D, yes, delta over Q, K over Q, where this K is hyperbolic tangent, epsilon Q divided by 2T divided by 2 epsilon Q. Right. Yes? Then this is the so-called gap equation. Yes? And in principle, it should allow you to find this delta, and the highest temperature at which you get a non-zero order parameter is just the transition temperature to this gapped spectrum which supports the phenomenon of superfluidity. But if your potential behaves itself as growing or repulsive coil, to deal with the Fourier transform here in the gap equation is absolutely horrible. Yes? Then what people do, they turn to the so-called renormalized gap equation. Usually this is done by turning to the so-called vertex function, and then you get an equation for the vertex function in terms of diagrams, and that's what you do. People from collisional physics, atomic spectroscopy, atomic physics, and quantum optics are usually very much depressed about that. I would say that this is all correct, but one should not forget that in the vertex function there is the energy or frequency argument. And for a special selection of this frequency argument, the vertex function is nothing else than the so-called off-shell scattering amplitude, which comes from two-body physics. Just let me introduce this. F over k prime k equals to integral exponent minus I k prime R U over R psi k over R d2 r. If modulus of k prime is equal to modulus k, this is nothing else than the ordinary on-shell scattering. Yes? Then there is a very well-known relation between the Fourier transform of the interaction potential and the off-shell scattering amplitude. It is the following: F tilde over k prime k equals to u over k prime k, sorry, k prime minus k, plus integral d2q divided by 2 pi squared, and here will be u over k prime minus k vector f over q, yes, f over 2k, yes, divided by E k minus E k prime minus I zero. Very well known relation. So what I do, I plug in this into this equation, and then this guy I replace U by the off-shell scattering amplitude, and in this case I obtain an equation for the order parameter, which looks like that. Delta k equals to minus f over tilde over k prime k. Here, delta k prime, k over k prime, yes, minus unity divided by 2 e k minus e k prime minus E0. Yes? And I think that I should put the integration D2 K prime divided by 2 pi squared. Yes? Now, in my case, which I am considering, the order parameter has S-wave symmetry. Yes? Then what I do, I multiply both sides by d phi k, this is the angle, and d phi k prime here is also an integrate. Yes? And then what I will do, I will take into account then also the contribution of this pole, because it's imaginary. Yes? And then what happens is that if you do this properly, you obtain the following equation, which is a very nice equation. Delta over k, which is already is having S-wave symmetry, minus, here I put principal value, f over k prime k multiplied delta k prime multiplied here k over k prime minus unity divided by 2 ek minus ek prime, yes, integral d2 k prime divided by 2 pi squared. So I took into account the symmetry of the other parameter, and then because of the contributions of the pole, I get here the imaginary parts cancel, and I get here my real amplitude f, which is for the on-shell case, is written here. So to deal with the principal value of unit divided by ek minus ek prime, it's trivial, yes? Therefore, this equation is very, very convenient for both analytical or numerical solution, because this guy is real. It's the two-particle quantity, off-shell S-wave scattering amplitude. What you simply do, you calculate it in a similar way as you calculate the on-shell. Then, here, I would like to make one more remark. Yes? The one more remark is the following. That once I do all this, and I have this equation where everything is like that, then, what happens is the following. Let me now solve this equation. You see here, there is this function, k over k prime, which is given by this relation. The main contribution to the integral here, let me put here k Fermi. Yes? This k I select arbitrarily. I can put it equal to k Fermi. Yes? The main contribution is then for k prime, k Fermi, for k prime close to k Fermi. And then in this amplitude, k prime can be put equal to k Fermi. I get the on-shell contribution. And then the overall calculation gives me integral f over k hyperbolic tangent ek prime minus e Fermi divided by 2t, divided by 2 ek prime minus e Fermi. I already assume that the order parameter here is zero and calculate the transition temperature. Yes? And this should be equal to one. Yes? This is the simplest version of the BCS approach, of course. Certainly, what I did not do, I did not include in this equation the effectiveness, the second order Gorkov, Midig, Barhudarov corrections, and so on. This all can be done. But then, after I do the integral, I get that the transition temperature, first of all, this integral gives logarithm, and the transition temperature will be Fermi energy with a numerical coefficient, which comes from some more sophisticated things, minus 2 pi h bar squared divided by m modulus f of k Fermi. Yes? And you know, then, look here. I calculated this f. Assume that this is zero, this is the main term, and this term is small. But now, if there is a small term in the first power, it is small, and I can throw it away. But here, f is in the exponent. This logarithm, bloody logarithm, which is here, I don't care of it. But exponent in the power logarithm is power, yes? So then, let me do a very simple exercise. Unity divided by modulus f will be equal to, if I just substitute this term and these two terms, it will be m divided by 2 pi h squared, then multiply pi divided by 4 k Fermi r star, the dipole-dipole length, yes, plus pi squared divided by 16, this alpha, yes, plus 3 pi squared divided by 32 logarithm k Fermi r star, right? And then I substitute this guy into here, and I get that my transition temperature is Fermi energy multiply exponent in the power of minus pi divided by 4 k Fermi r star, yes, and here will be, because of this, there will be exponent in the power of minus pi squared divided by 16, I think alpha, yes. And then also the next term coming from here, let me find the next term. And the next term is, it's here. Minus exponent in the power of minus 3 pi squared divided by 32 logarithm k Fermi aster. You see that aside from a numerical coefficient, there is this guy here. And then, if I do all calculations, yes, maybe I just remove all this, yes, then what happens is that I get that exponent in the power minus logarithm, its power, then I get E Fermi divided by K Fermi R star in the power, which is 3 pi squared divided by 32 is almost 1, yes? So this will be E Fermi in the power 1/2, atomic energy in the power 1/2, multiplied exponent in the power minus pi over 4 K Fermi R star. You see that the dipole-dipole effect, this logarithm, they even change the power of the Fermi energy in front of the exponent. This is in contrast to all these second-order Gorkov, Milik, Barhudarov corrections, which give just a numerical effect. And I did some estimates, and then it turns out that taking into account this type of k-squared log terms, it changes the final result by a factor of 5, 6, 7. It's not 2 orders of magnitude, but it's something. And you know, this is important because if you obtain in the simple BCS approach, let's say 5 nanokelvin, but then this effect increases the result by factor 6, you get 30 nanokelvin or even 50 nanokelvin. And the difference in between 5 nanokelvin and 50 nanokelvin for experiments, I think, is important, isn't it? Then, what happens here, that for realistic parameters that I substitute for the Fermi energy of the system, which goes to one or several microkelvin, 1, 2, 3 microkelvin, and densities tend to, let's say, 2 × 10⁻⁹, the transition temperature will be about 50 nanokelvin or even 70 nanokelvin. But I would like to emphasize that whatever you do, the details of the scattering theory should become important, especially for fermions, yes? Because, you know, the scattering amplitude is in the exponent, yes? And small term in the exponent, together with a large term, can give a significant result. And therefore, I would say that if you do the scattering theory and calculate the off-shell scattering amplitude, then this is the gap equation where you get this real off-shell scattering amplitude, then this equation is very convenient. What I simply demonstrated here is the very first simple approach to get the result. Of course, when I was writing papers, we were solving this equation nicely, and there are analytical and numerical methods to solve it. It's not that difficult. The only message that I would like to convey at this point, I don't mind whether one does it analytically or numerically, but please take into account, let's say, it thoroughly, including this type of terms, yes? And then the final result can be changed by almost an order of magnitude, factor 5, 6, 8, yes? So the message that I'm going to send is that there is a direct connection between the scattering theory or collisional physics, if you wish. In this audience, I can replace the term scattering theory by collisional physics, yes? And it may lead to very interesting effects in the spectrum of bosons, as I showed you the supersolid spectrum. It may lead to interesting effects for superfluid pairing for fermions. Yes? And then I think that, oh, I have to stop. Thank you.